All right, well, we'll go ahead and get started. If it's ever late, we just wander in. So we'll start with a prayer. Father Nicholas, would you kick us off with a prayer, please?
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name, thy kingdom come. Thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from the evil one. Glory to the Father, and to the Son, and to the Holy Spirit, now and ever, and up to the ages of ages. Amen. Lord, have mercy. Lord, have mercy. Lord, have mercy. Father, bless.
Say, Christ, our true God, guide us as we approach this holy subject of the fire that descends from heaven. Help us, O Lord, to be receptive through your guidance, through your inspiration, and through your instruction. May we be attentive and seek to know you better through this experience. Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Amen.
Okay, so this subject of sacred and holy fire, maybe some of you have never even heard of. Has everybody heard of it, or is there a few that have not heard of it? Who has not heard of it? Everyone's heard of it, at least. Okay, but they call it the best-kept secret in America, because hardly anybody has heard of it outside the Orthodox Church. And why is this? I don't really know. I don't know why no one has really heard of it. Because it's a miracle that is done in full view of thousands of people every year. And you would think there would at least be controversy over it, and that people outside the church would at least be saying, oh yeah, that's white sulfur or white phosphorus or whatever. It is, charlatan's work and all this. Yeah, but people aren't even saying that. They don't even know about it. And so it is a hidden secret of our church, and yet it's not a secret. Some would say it's deeply connected with the very essence of our church, and I might agree. And I'll talk about why. But I'll just do kind of a historical background first. And there's this book right here by Harris Sarlakidis. And he has written this book called The Holy Fire. And it came out, I think, in 2010, I believe. But anyway, it's fairly recent. But he has put together, and what's unique about this book right here, and it's available, I think, in the bookstore, is that it has historical accounts all the way back to as far as we can find them. And the historical documents are actually reprinted in here. So if it's an Arabic document, he's got the Arabic written in here and a photo of that document. Because he says, you know, people can go in, lose documents, or the original research can be lost or whatever. He wants it to be preserved, which is very good. So he has put a lot of research into how far back can we go with this phenomenon. And as far back as we can tell, now of course you know that Queen Helen built the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. So here's some models of that church. But it incorporates both Golgotha and the tomb. You may or may not know that, but it's a huge church. It's like 2 football fields long and about probably a football field wide. It's huge. So this was built. Now, much of the church is from a later date, and we'll see why. But the original basilica was built in the 300s. By Queen Helen. And so we remember, and it's too long to get into how it was found with the three crosses and so forth, but she found the place, right, that had been filled in by the Romans. They had conquered Jerusalem in 70 AD, and they wanted to wipe Judaism off the face of the earth, right? And so they basically renamed it Aelia Anatolia. Is that right? Yeah, and then they filled in where Christ's tomb was. They put a temple to Aphrodite there, it was totally, you know, they erased everything from Judaism and Christianity, both. But she found this location, and that's preserved in our church, the story of that, you can find that. And this basilica was built right on the spot, okay? And why? Because this is where the Christians said, from memory, this is where we had worshipped and where the tomb was. So the first actual recording of when this occurred was in the 300s, shortly after the church. And so there was St. Gregory the Illuminator. He was from Armenia, actually, but he went to Jerusalem. It wasn't uncommon for somebody other than the Patriarch of Jerusalem to celebrate this rite, apparently. The abbot of the monastery that was nearby celebrated this as the chief celebrant. St. Gregory, being the chief hierarch, may have participated, very likely participated. But from the year 300, it says in Armenian, they say that St. Gregory placed a lamp over the tomb of Christ and beseeched God with his prayers that on the feast of Easter, the place be lit with an immaterial light, something which occurs down to our own day. And this was written about the 800s. And so this was the first recording of somebody in the 300s actually experiencing this phenomenon. So the holy fire or the holy light is a phenomenon that occurs at sundown, in essence, or vespers of Holy Saturday. So in other words, as we come into Sunday, okay, and this is an important point. So as we come into Sunday with the vespers of Sunday, it happens. And so we have another appearance in 617. Now you may or may not know that the Persians destroyed Jerusalem in the 600s, and they killed tens of thousands of people. It was horrific. They destroyed the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. And yet, even amidst the destruction, the holy fire came. And this really encouraged the Christians in the city. Within 2 years of the destruction, they were rebuilding the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. And but in the midst of the rubble, even, they record the fire came. So this was a phenomenon that was well known. Later, we're going to go to some Arabic sources. And I have to put on my glasses here. But the Arabic sources are even photocopied to some extent in this book. So in other words, here's some Arabic, an Arabic document that talks about it. But this is one of the most powerful arguments for the holy fire. In other words, what particular reason would the Muslims find to be touting a miracle like this, right? Wouldn't they want to cover it up? Wouldn't they want to pretend that it's all fakery and completely discredit it? I would think they would. They would certainly not be supporting something like this. As a matter of fact, it was known to be a number one conversion item for people from the Islamic faith to come to Christianity. But this was in... so basically... This was from the holy fire al-Biruni, I'm not sure I'm saying it correctly, but around the year 1000, he wrote this. He says, with regard to the Saturday of the Resurrection, there's a story told that surpasses the researcher of natural sciences and the cause of which is impossible to be discovered. If there was no consensus of the miracle and they had not attested that they had personally seen it, and even leading teachers and other individuals had not related it in their works, one could not have any trust in it at all. I have learned from it from books and have heard it from Al-Faraj ibn Salah of Baghdad. In the middle of the church in Jerusalem, there is a carved rock of the tomb of Jesus in such a manner that it's enveloped by a dome. Overhead there's a larger dome, and around the rock are galleries from which Muslims watch. The Christians and anyone else who comes that day to the place of the tomb pray and call upon the Almighty God from noon until nightfall. Even the muezzin of the mosque, the head imam of the prayer, and the emir of the city come and sit next to the tomb. With them, they bring oil lamps, which they place on top. While the tomb is sealed, the Christians in the meantime have already extinguished their lamps and torches and wait until they see a clear fire which lights the lamp. From this fire, the lamps in the mosque and the churches are lit. Next, there is a written report to the caliph concerning the exact time that the flame descended. From the speed of the coming of the fire, and if it was near noon, they conclude that the year would be productive. And coming towards nightfall, and even later, they conclude it would not be productive. He who informed me relates that a certain sultan put a copper wire in place of the wick, so it would not light and would not take place. However, when the fire descended, the copper ignited. The coming of that day of the fire from the sky, which recurs at a specific place and time, is a cause for all of us to be in awe. Now, that is not a Christian writer. That's a Muslim. And he was a very strict Islamic scholar. And so this is very powerful evidence that we've got something that is not just being touted by Christians, you know, to try to pull one over on people. And so that is one of the strongest pieces of evidence here. So what he is talking about is the placing of the copper. Okay, so just to give you a sense of what's going on here, there's what's called an edicule, and the edicule contains where Jesus was laid out. So in other words, there's a bench there, which is actually covered in marble right now. But there, that underneath that bench, underneath that marble, which is where liturgies are celebrated, there is the stone that Jesus was laid on. It's there. That is it, okay? And it is surrounded by this little edicule. It's a little teeny holy place. I don't know how to describe it, but it's
tiny. It was the tomb.
It's a tomb.
It was his tomb.
It's a building.
Yeah, it was his tomb. I mean, that bench is where he was laid, absolutely. And it's only about 2 arms wide, something like that.
Yes.
And about from here would be the entry, and your exit is probably kind of like right where I'm standing, I'd say. Is that right? You've been there more recently than I have, but I think it's about like that. So maybe 2 arms wide and about from me to the cross there. Okay? That's how big it is. And it contains the bench, the stone bench that Christ was laid upon. Yes?
I think the entrance and the exit are the same, if I remember when I was there. Come out the same way.
Yeah, you do. On the back side, there is a little opening, and there's somebody that can sit in a little niche there. That's right. But yeah, the entry and the exit are the same. That's true. Yep. And so that's about the space that we're talking about. And so this fire has been coming every year. Now, he kind of argues in this book that the original fire happened at Pascha. Which makes sense, because we read in the gospel, you know, we can think about this how we want, but he argues that when Saints Peter and John ran to the cave and checked out what was in there, they could see the linen clothes lying by themselves and the covering that was about his head and so forth. How could they see it? You know, we could say, well, they had torches or something, but he says they probably didn't, that the light that was there was the immaterial light of the holy fire. That's what was there. And that's why the women could see when they were there too. But of course, even in Matins today, we talk about their souls being illumined with the uncreated light. We read that in Matins this morning. So whether it was torches that they had plus the glow of Easter, but he makes this argument that it was the holy fire, that very first Easter. And so we would assume it's been happening every year since the very first Easter. Okay, and I think that's probably true. So, it comes either when Vespers starts and so on and so forth, but another point he makes in here is that in 614, when they wanted the fire to come, it was ordered by the patriarch to sing, O Gladsome Light. And I read this book before, but I had not considered that. O Gladsome Light is in Vespers. Every Vespers has O Gladsome Light of the Holy Glory of the Immortal, Heavenly, Holy, Blessed Father, Jesus Christ, and so forth. That is known as the most ancient hymn that we have in our church. We even have record of it from the 2nd century. This prayer goes all the way back, as far as we can tell, to the beginning. What he is saying in here is that that O Gladsome Light directly relates to the Holy Fire. In other words, as the setting of the sun happens at Pascha, it's the evening starts the day in Judaism and in our church. The sun goes down, it's Sunday. As soon as the sun's down, it's the third day. He's arguing that's when the resurrection occurs. They sang, O Gladsome Light, at Vespers of Pascha, the holy fire came from the rubble of the church. Okay, so very interesting. So let's go forward a little bit more in time. So we've got the Muslims, even, not only are they saying it occurs, But very interestingly, they take the fire back to their mosque. There's the Al-Aqsa Mosque and there's the Dome of the Rock up on top. They took the fire to those. You know? And if it's so wrong, why did they do that? So let's see. Then, something also that I really was not very aware of. In the year 1001, the Fatimid Caliph of Egypt, Al-Hakim, and the Byzantine Emperor entered into a 10-year truce agreement. The Caliph, whose mother was a Christian named Maria, had risen to the throne at the age of 11, but he was a religious fanatic. We've never heard of Muslim religious fanatics, I don't think. But anyway, he basically decides that this holy fire has to be ended. There were too many Muslims becoming Christian. So what does he do? He orders the complete destruction of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. This is something we don't hear much about. I don't think we know about this here. But in the year 1000, right around then, he completely destroys the Church of the Holy Sepulchre and demands that not even one stone be left, right? And so they tear it down. There's records of them finding coins and things that were left in the walls at the time of its building from Queen Helen and things like that. They completely destroyed it. They tried to destroy the bench where Jesus was laid with pickaxes and everything. It was, they said, harder than diamond. They couldn't do it. But everything else they were able to tear down. And then they went to the other churches and destroyed them. So there were apparently thousands of churches that were destroyed at this time. And but they went to Bethlehem, and they intended to destroy the church at Bethlehem, but they reported there were there was light and angels there to tell them not to. So they didn't, and then they went out to Sinai to try to destroy St. Catherine's, and they saw a huge light in the sky above the monastery, and the fire was enveloping the monastery and smoking, and they said, "We better not." And they went and told the Caliph, you know, there were two places that we didn't get. but this is in their own records, too. And so I think, wow, this is interesting.
And so what about the fire that year?
Well, that year, no, that year it did come, yes. And so basically what happened is there wasn't a there was no church around it. And the edicule, the roof had been torn off. It was still there with just partial walls of the little edicule, and they served the liturgy, but they were surrounded by Muslims who were hostile and throwing rocks at them. They were throwing rocks continuously during Holy Week and especially before the Holy Fire, and they were threatening them that if the Holy Fire didn't come, they would kill all of them. So no pressure. And let's see, it's written down exactly what happened here. Let's see if I can find that. Well, I knew I wouldn't be able to put my finger on it right away. At any rate, the Holy Fire did come. And so the Muslims were amazed, obviously.
Did they stop throwing rocks?
I'm not sure. They did for that year, but I think the next year they were back at it. So anyway, the church was rebuilt. Oh, here it is. The day of Holy Saturday arrived when the fire of the Lord was expected, and while the Christians were confined inside waiting to receive the fire through the goodwill of the Lord, armed Muslims carefully monitored the entire church so that if the light didn't arrive, they would all be put to death by the sword. And behold, around the ninth hour, when they were praying, one lamp lit with the fire of the Lord without the help of anyone. And all the heathens were gripped by amazement and dread, and indeed the Christians by joy and exaltation. So the way they did it back then is the edicule here would be locked and no one would be in it. And they would put seals on it. And they'd have a lamp in there. And they would pray outside. And the fire would come and ignite the lamp inside the tomb that was sitting on the bench where his tomb was. And that's how it was celebrated. Now, around 1400, for reasons that aren't totally clear, they changed it so the patriarch would go inside and say the prayer right at the bench. So ever since 1400 or so, it's been going on that way.
Did they people can actually see it.
What's that?
Yeah, so people can actually see it.
Yeah, that's right. And so one of the things about the holy fire is, so no one was in there, and people could see that, because there are like portholes, at least now there are, but there was like a grill back in that time, mm-hmm. you could see in, and you could see that the light lit by itself. And so no one could say this wasn't a miracle. You know, no one could say, well, there was somebody in there doing something. There wasn't, you know. And so up from the records we have, from 300 to 1400, that's how it happened every year. But from 1400 on, the patriarch goes inside. But we are... Go ahead.
Inside where it is pitch dark.
Yes. Now, the next big event was the Crusades. Now, the Crusades came, and the church was taken over by the capture of Jerusalem by the Crusaders in 1099. And this is a lot to read, but nearly 10,000 were beheaded in the temple by the Crusaders, by the way. If you had been there, your feet would have been stained to the ankles in the blood. None of them were left alive, and they didn't even spare women and children. It was not alone the spectacle of the headless bodies and mutilated limbs strewn in all directions that aroused them. Still more dreadful it was to gaze upon the victors themselves, dripping with blood from head to foot, an ominous sign that brought terror to everyone that saw it. So that's an eyewitness account. What's that?
This was in the church?
Yeah. Yeah, they killed everyone.
They went into the church when the people were
yeah.
waiting.
They wanted to have... Yeah, and so the... And the same thing happened yes. with the Persians. They killed everyone in the church. The Crusaders did the same thing. They killed everyone that was seeking refuge in the church. But a lot of the Crusaders knew that was a bad sign. They knew that was not good to have done that. Okay? So unlike the Persians, they kind of had a conscience and said, we probably shouldn't have done that, but they did it. Yeah. So at any rate... What they decided to do, and he's got all kinds of sources. He's got like 15 different sources, eyewitness accounts, everything. But just boiling it down, he said the Latin clergy, or the Roman Catholics, decided that they were going to take charge of this ceremony of the Holy Fire. And so they put their patriarchal leader of Jerusalem in charge of the ceremony. Guess which year was the only year in recorded history that the fire did not come. It was that year of 1100 that the fire did not come. And so the Roman Catholics were very afraid after that, because they were already knowing that this was not good what they did, and then their leader could not make the fire come with the correct prayers or anything. So they left, and their King Baldwin was like dining on Pascha, but they were all still dressed in purple because it was still lent to them that the fire hadn't come. So they were very sad. When they left, the Orthodox clergy went in. They started to say the prayers. The fire came when the Roman Catholics were gone, and they started to run back when they heard news that the fire has come, the fire has come. It happened on the next morning, which it never had done before, but after the Orthodox clergy had gone in, and they only came in as spectators. After that, they gave the ceremony back to the Orthodox. They figured that was probably the best course of action, and it's been that way ever since. So that's interesting, okay? Then the next event would be Saladin, you know, who had also captured Constantinople. He captured Jerusalem from the Crusaders. This was about 80 years after this. And... he ordered that the Orthodox clergy were in charge, and that if any Muslim touched that church, that they should be killed. It's very interesting. And he was also very merciful to the Christians. So it's one of the rare instances where a victor has spared people. So we do have to remember that. And to this day, Muslims will not touch that church for that reason, apparently. Yes?
That was only a period of a few years of peace, though.
Well, no. I mean, even to today, this is still true.
There's a Muslim family that's the keeper of the door to that church.
Right.
It's hereditary.
Right. So then the next event, probably that we should be aware of, is in 1500s, where the Armenians bought the right to go in and have their patriarch do the ceremony of the holy fire. So they thought they'd try it. The Latin experience, I guess, wasn't good enough for them. So they bought the emir's blessing to go ahead and do it. And he got the money, and they got the blessing. They went into the church and started to say the prayers, except it didn't happen as they thought. The Orthodox were out in the courtyard, and when the time for the holy fire came, it burst through the pillar on the left side of the door, went out to the Orthodox, lit all of their candles. The ruler of Jerusalem, Muslim ruler of Jerusalem, was sitting watching this from a booth up above. He said immediately, "Great is the God of the Christians," and became a Christian at that moment, was immediately beheaded by his Muslim followers as a heretic. And it was quite the scene. But that scorch mark still exists, and you can go see it. And apparently in this book, he says, was analyzed by a famous Russian scientist who said, you know, that could only have been caused by an electrical discharge, according to him. But there are scorch marks, there's evidence from exactly that time. All eyewitnesses say it happened. So there wasn't anyone who said, no, that's not what happened. The Armenians knew it happened. They didn't even try to participate in the Holy Fire ceremony for decades after that. Okay? So.
But now the Armenians are the ones who frisk the Orthodox right. patriarch before he goes in to make sure he doesn't have a match.
Yep. Yep. Tradition. So when he goes in, you know, that he is totally checked out for a Bic lighter or whatever, and he doesn't have it. But it's been going on. So then he's got all kinds of eyewitness accounts since the 1500s, of course, and they get more and more frequent as we come closer to our own time. And there's lots and lots of eyewitness accounts from the 1700s and 1800s. So it's continuous line, we would say, from the beginning. Here's the scorch marks on the pillar. You can see. Anyone can come up and look at this book if you want. Or you can buy it downstairs. Then we come up to the 1800s, and that's where this little book comes in. This is I Saw the Holy Light is the name of this book. And this was by a man who, this Greek priest encountered this man. He's Monk Mitrofanis, and he was the keeper of the little edicule, right? This was his duty as a monk. But he originally came from Turkey, a Greek community there in the 1920s, when his communities were being slaughtered. You know, it was genocide at that time. And he was the only one of his family to survive. He made it overland, a long, arduous journey, and just somehow knew that he wanted to go to Jerusalem. He was offered to be with the Syrian patriarch and be his reader and things, and he just said, no, I'm going to Jerusalem. So he went to Jerusalem. He was accepted as a monk there. He became a keeper of the tomb. And he tells his story. So this priest from Greece came, and he was very interested to learn this man's story. And he said, you know what? Since you're asking, I'll tell you a very interesting story. So he did. And that's what this book is about. He said, you know, at a certain point, doubt took over. I had doubt in my mind. And I was thinking that these Orthodox patriarchs and clergy are lying, that it's not like that, that they're using white sulfur or something, and that this is not a real miracle. And he just couldn't get it out of his mind, you know, like the demons were playing with him. And he just was feeling terrible, just awful, that, you know, this was something that was not right. And so he conceived a plan. He conceived a plan to hide himself in the little edicule up on a shelf up above. And watch what happened. He said he just couldn't survive without knowing. He had to know. Kind of like St. Thomas, you know, he had to know. So it took a lot of doing, and you got to read the book to find out exactly how he got in there. But he ensconced himself at Friday midnight or so. And he put himself up there. And the Orthodox did a liturgy first, then the Armenians came in, then the Roman Catholics came in, and they all did their little liturgies. He was afraid he was going to cough, you know, and people were going to pull him down and, you know, give in to him. But he managed to hang in there. and all the way till Vespers on Holy Saturday. And all the lights were out, as Ruth said. It was dark in there. And I've got it marked where he has his experience. So I'm going to read that to you. His experience while he's hiding up in that little area. It says, "My excitement had reached a fearful peak, yet I was so immersed in an endless silence that I could hear my own breath. Suddenly came the sound of a soft whistling. It was similar to a fine breeze of wind, and immediately an unforgettable sight, a blue light, filled the entire tomb. That blue light was going round and round, exactly like a whirlwind whose force uproots the tallest trees, grasps them, and carries them off. The restless blue light gyrated with lightning speed, and then the movement slowed down. Within that light, I saw very clearly the patriarch. Drops of perspiration trickled down his face. As he was kneeling, he placed his finger at the opening in the holy book where the candle was. In the meantime, he placed on the tomb four bundles, each containing 33 candles. When the mysterious light changed to a steady glow, the patriarch opened to the candle page, and he began to read the prayers. Then the somewhat blue light began to move. It was unimaginable and indescribable, whirling, stronger than the first time. Immediately it began to change into an all-white light as at the transfiguration of Christ. Gradually the all-white light began to take the form of a disk more brilliant than the sun and stopped motionless over the head of the patriarch. I saw the patriarch take in his hands the bundles of candles. He raised them and waited. He was awaiting the arrival of the elusive light from God. As he raised his hands slowly, not quite reaching the height of his head, instantaneously, as if he were touching a lighted furnace, the holy cantilla candles burst into flames, and the bright disk vanished before me, and my eyes filled with tears." So that was his experience, and he was a believer after that. and he repented, and he had to, his conscience would not allow him not to make a confession to the patriarch. So he confessed to the patriarch what he had done. Of course, he got absolution, but this was his story to tell.
It's very interesting what the patriarch did. When he was only 26 years old. Mm-hmm. He was just a kid, you know, and subsequently became a monk. When he told the patriarch and confessed to the patriarch, he was sure he was going to just be decapitated. It was a huge crime to be in there. And the patriarch started to cry and said, "What did it look like? I didn't see any of it."
Right. Yeah.
He saw the candles burst into flame.
Of course.
But that was long after the whole thing. But it's interesting that that light does not obscure anything. If that light were in this room, it would be brighter than the sun, but we could see every detail of these things here, of the furnishings. It doesn't cast a shadow. There's no shadow to it.
So here's Bishop Christodoulos in 1998, and here's an interview with him. So basically he says, "Over the Easter period 1998, Patriarch Diodorus was suffering from an illness, and for the first time since he was in office was not able to do the Holy Fire ceremony alone. A few days after his interview, he was conveyed on a chair to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, and once he reached the entry, he entered the monument's antechamber. It was not possible for him to enter the tomb's inner chamber on account of the narrowness of the entry and the fact that he was in a wheelchair. Bishop Christodoulos was ordained deacon and had lived in Jerusalem since 1957, and then he was a bishop. In a conversation in January 2010, he described in particularly revealing manner what went on. And basically, he says, as he was reading the prayer, he noticed the tombstone had begun to perspire. As time went on, the phenomenon became more intense, and it was as completely covered with liquid myrrh that came out of its interior. At the same time, along with the liquid myrrh, a very intense blue light appeared, which covered the entire tomb. At that moment, the holy oil lamp miraculously ignited. And is this what you lit from the bundles of your candles from the lamp? No, it was not necessary. I held the bundles of the candles over the tombstone, over the blue light, and they immediately ignited." So there was a bishop's eyewitness account right there. And someone asked him, "Well, do you believe in the phenomenon?" He says, "Why would I doubt it? I know it occurs." So these are eyewitness accounts from the past, from our own times. Yes, yes. And so I had the chance to go myself. But I also want to make the comment before I do that, that when we have our Pascha, right, that at midnight, we all rush, the church is darkened, and we all rush forward to receive the light. That is an exact duplicate of what happens with the holy fire in Jerusalem. So in other words, we are recreating that moment here in our church, and it was very, very common, still is, for people to take the holy fire from Jerusalem, take it back to their churches, and have that flame on lit above the altar and so forth, and that's, we light it. But notice that in his bishop's account, the light is coming from the tomb itself. It's coming from the rock of the tomb, the same rock that the Muslims could not hack apart as much as they tried. That's where the light is coming from. It's coming from the, well, every time. Yeah, it comes down to, but I'm saying in that time, it's from that tomb. The source of our resurrection, and that's one of our prayers in the Orthodox Church, you know, the tomb is the fountain of our resurrection, isn't it? It says that. And so this is very interesting. So this is deeply connected with Pascha. It's connected with our salvation, with our faith, and yet it happens every year. So yeah, I also had an experience in 1987 of going to Greece first, and I went to Mount Athos. Beautiful. I had a wonderful experience, but that's not what I want to talk about. But I went to a skete there, where at that time, the Russian Orthodox Church abroad had a skete of Prophet Elias. And the abbot there spoke some English, not too much, you know, and was talking to me and so forth. But basically, I was trying to maybe spend Pascha on Mount Athos because I thought, well, that would be the perfect place to do it. Wow, what can you get any better? And but he said, no, I want to tell you a story. So he told me a story. There was a man in World War II, and they had gone to Jerusalem. This man was Orthodox, but his friend was not Orthodox. His friend was skeptical. And so he wanted to take him to see the holy fire. And since it was wartime, there weren't many people in Jerusalem, you know, that they were either fighting or somewhere dispersed. So they were able to get into the church, and he and his friend were able to go and stand right near where they could look right into the edicule, right to see exactly what happened. And so they stood there, and when the time came, and the time it comes is Vespers on Holy Saturday. You know when we do the pots and pans? That's when it comes. And we pop out of the altar with a white vestment on. That is when this occurs. And, you know, anyway, in Jerusalem, they're banging the taba drums. They're on each other's shoulders. They're ululating. I mean, this is one of the things that people say that are against it and worry about it. They say, well, you know, there shouldn't be such tumult. If it was really the Holy Spirit, there wouldn't be that kind of reaction. Well, okay, whatever. That's what people say. But anyway, these two men were there. They were looking into the tomb, and the tomb began to glow blue, very intense blue. And then all of a sudden, candles around them began to light spontaneously on their own. And then the patriarch came out with his candles lit, the four bundles of 33, and started to distribute the fire. Well, this man's friend, who the abbot had known personally, became an Orthodox Christian after this. So he said, because this happened to him, I think you should go to Jerusalem and see this event instead of staying here on Mount Athos. You know, I think it would be nice for you to stay, but I think you should go to Jerusalem. So I followed his advice, went to Jerusalem. I was there for all of Holy Week, a little bit before, actually. And so I was able to go through the whole cycle and ended up going to church on Holy Friday. I met a man who was a Catholic seminarian, and he was very interested to go as well. So I was talking to him at where I was staying, which was near there in a small little place. But anyway, I managed to get in. There was lots and lots of people, to say the least. You had to stand for hours because basically if you weren't there Friday night, you didn't get in. So, and sleep in the church, and then, you know, stay there all the next morning until the ceremony started around 11 in the morning and went till about 2 in the afternoon, something like that. And so the patriarch comes in, he has his Turkish guards that are, you know, putting their staffs to the floor and clearing the way. He goes around the tomb 3 times, and then, as Ruth pointed out, the Armenian patriarch looks up his sleeve, makes sure he doesn't have a Bic lighter in there or anything, and he walks into the edicule, and he begins his special prayers. And so I was fairly close. I'd say I was... maybe where the porch is out there from the edicule, so not so far. And there are currently portholes in the side, you know, that are openings, so you can kind of see in a little bit. And so when the patriarch went in, what I saw was, yes, a light, a flash of lightning that came from the dome of the top of the church to the top of the edicule. I saw that. And then just after that, it was like flamethrowers were coming out of those portholes. In other words, there was so much flame coming out of these, you couldn't even, I mean, it looked like whoever was in there was just engulfed in flame. You couldn't imagine it. And the flames were just coming out of these portholes. People were lighting their candles off of the portholes before the patriarch even came out. And then I looked up, kind of like on that balcony area, and there were people that already had their candles lit. They were just lighting spontaneously. And then he came out with the holy fire. Everyone rushed forward in a great mass. Everyone got their candles lit. And I had heard that it doesn't burn initially. So, of course, I wanted to check this out. And so I had my candle lit, stuck my finger right in there, and it was cool. Yeah, I could just hold my finger in there for, I don't know how long it was, but much longer than it would have been to cause me to get burned, for sure. So it is cool. And this is something that's reported. They say it has to go to 3 people before it starts acting like normal fire. Before that, you can move it around. It's not burning you. It has different properties. So my experience of it was like a sacred experience. It was like, you know, you're bathed in grace. I don't know how to describe it. But there's many, many other eyewitness accounts. Sometimes it appears like a dove to some people. Sometimes it's a white light. Sometimes it's intensely blue. Other times it has other characteristics like lightning. So anyway, I left, and not knowing exactly what was going to happen, you know, I didn't realize that there was many other services to come. But I did meet this Roman Catholic seminary student, and he had come, so he couldn't get in. So he was out in the courtyard, but I told him that at a particular moment in time, I saw the lightning come from the top of the church to the top of the edicule. He said, you know, I saw at that exact moment something come from the sky to the top of the church. So that was my own eyewitness experience of this. And yes, did it change my life? Absolutely. I don't know, but I hope so. So, you know, it's happened every year. It's connected with O Gladsome Light. It's connected with the resurrection from the tomb. It is a phenomena that, you know, is well attested by many people. We also recreate it during our services at Pascha. It's connected very centrally with our experience of Christ. So why isn't it reported more widely?
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know. But it is one of those inner experiences of the church, I believe. And it's something that everyone should participate in if you can, I think. But we do. You know, it to me, it's the uncreated light. It is the resurrection. It's that restoration that Christ came to give us. And but it's in an inexplicable way. So there's a lot of it that we just can't explain. And that's wonderful, because that is partly why I became Orthodox, like I told you last week. Here's the church where I can't explain everything. I can't nail it all down and tell you everything about it. Well, that makes sense, because it's God. So does anybody have questions? Yes?
I don't know if you might have said something about this, but I've been late. I have read that it only comes on the old calendar, Pascha.
Well, there is no new calendar possible. In other words, for Orthodox, we're all on the old calendar when we celebrate. When we go into the Lenten season, we're all old calendar.
Oh.
The Western Church does not celebrate it on
so
the same day.
The Western Church, in other words, it does not come on Western Easter, if that's your question. Right. Yes?
I just wondered what year that was when you were there.
1987.
And then, if I can ask, I wasn't able to attend last week, but you're a scientist, and did you go through all kinds of things in your mind trying to know how this is happening?
Not so much. not so much. No, because I was on a spiritual thing, you know, at that time. And the abbot had told me this was the best thing, and I certainly believed it after seeing this. How could you top that? I mean, you can't. But plus, just experiencing it. I mean, there were people that I met outside the church that didn't believe it. I did encounter that. But what can I say? You know, I experienced what I experienced, and I felt what I felt. To me, it was more important what I felt here, even, than almost seeing it. Because I just felt, I don't know how to describe it, I just felt that this was real. Yeah, yes.
There, in that book, the big one that you have on your lap there, there's quite a few people who are saying, who have reported the fact, that what was the biggest proof to them was the changes in the countenances of all the people who had received the light, whether it was from another candle or just spontaneous.
Yes.
There's many recordings in there about how the people themselves are glowing and just totally transfigured.
This is what you're all talking about. See their faces? This is what was convincing to me. So, yes, you're right. Go ahead.
Are there any circumstances that have been written about whether people at the same time see different things?
They do, yes. People see different things. Some people don't see anything. Some people see it. Some people, it just depends. Some people see, as I say, a shape. Some people don't. Some people see white. Some people see blue. Everyone seems to have a different experience of it. But he also reports in here, I didn't see it in here this time, but he reported that in 2011, something like that, 2010, 11, 12, that before the Holy Fire, there was a completely circular rainbow around the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, visible to everyone from 8 in the morning till the Holy Fire came.
Wow.
3 years recently. Yeah, it's interesting. And that is not widely reported either. Yes?
What's with the 33 candles?
Well, the life of Christ is 33 years. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was not. I became Orthodox after that. Yeah. So I came back to America thinking that, yes, I was going to be baptized Orthodox no matter what. My brothers and sisters here in America decided they were going to do the same thing. So here I am.
It's amazing how that light works.
It is.
To your family. I mean, God never blesses one.
Right. No? Yes?
We were there in 1987.
Okay, also.
Also. Ah. We were invited by the patriarch to stand on the statue exit.
Okay.
Immediately up to the right.
Okay.
On the second floor.
Ah, near the Golgotha?
No, it was the other
side. On the other side, okay. So kind of like where I was describing. Yes. Did you see some candles light spontaneously?
Absolutely.
Lucky. You were there?
Yes.
Okay, lucky. Wow, amazing.
He was one of those people in the balcony.
He was standing next to you.
He was close to me. He was maybe one with right up there. Okay,
he
amazing.
Orthodox either.
Uh-huh.
Until later.
Amazing, okay, wow. Well, I am, see, this is extra confirmation. I don't need extra confirmation, but there it is.
To explain it.
But somebody here does, obviously. Yes.
But it was real.
It is real. It is real. So don't doubt it. This is a holy thing of God. And, you know,
we have to treasure it. And this is, you know, but it is available to us. Any other questions? Yes.
If you went to the press at that time,
yeah,
would they laugh at you?
No, I don't think so.
Would they publish something?
Well, NPR had a thing on it in 2006. It was very neutral. It was just kind of saying Christians gather here. They believe that, you know, this and that. I mean, you do see it in the press occasionally. Probably the press where they do report on it more would be the Russian press. And they have had articles in Russian papers on it.
You mean in Russia?
Yeah, in Russia.
In Russia.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You could also YouTube it.
Yes.
Yeah. I watched it. Yeah. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. So there are some people that have had videos, and there are some still frames from videos in this book. Yeah, he actually starts with one. These are just still frames from a video somebody took. But it shows the fire coming. And like Ruth's saying, this picture up here, and Christopher might be able to talk to us about this, but the light coming in this picture doesn't have any shadows. You know, a light coming on a candle or a torch would have shadows all over the place. This doesn't. Is that true, Christopher? And then the fire ignites, and it's 0.04 seconds later. It's like, it's so fast. It's like one frame later, the candles are lit. So, yeah. So people have filmed this. You can find it.
And
yes?
Have you ever contemplated putting a camera in there so that people outside of the church, or I mean,
well,
around the world, could perhaps watch as it's happening?
You know, if people want to know, they will.
They can come and see it.
If somebody just wants to have confirmation of something inside of themselves, this is often a way that it's expressed, that they'll find themselves there and go, you know. My sister was there the day after. She was there on Sunday. Mm-hmm. And her response to the liturgy that occurred on Sunday, and her response to being there was, I went in Presbyterian, I came out Orthodox, I didn't understand a thing, what shall I do now?
Yeah, and so this goes right along with, you know, the emir of Egypt saying, this is the biggest calling card the Christians have.
We got to stop it, but he couldn't.
We got to stop it. He tried to stop it. So before he tore down the church, right, that's when he ordered that a metal wick be used. And, of course, that didn't stop the holy fire. It came anyway. Anybody else with a question? Yes?
About how many people gather there every
year? Oh, it's thousands. I mean, I would estimate maybe, 2,500 people.
So,
and then the whole courtyard
inside,
and all around the church also is just full of people.
Yeah.
So many thousands of people.
Many thousands.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's in full view. No one's hiding anything.
Is it difficult to get inside?
It is very, very. So you have to go in Friday night and stay there.
Standing.
Yeah. Well,
I know a monk that went there during the Holy Fire. He says, you can hardly move.
Yeah, you can't move.
There's so many people. If you fall down, you just stay standing up because you can't fall down.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, we have never seen it packed like this in this church.
No.
We're talking.
No, it's packed. Absolutely packed. Well, but worth it. Yes. Maria.
When you went to Mount Athos.
Yeah.
You were not Orthodox at that time.
Right.
Yeah, so anybody can go? I mean, and a woman can't.
Right. Yes, you can. They will give you a 3-day permit, and you can stay longer if you get a blessing. So I actually stayed somewhat longer and intended to stay a lot longer, but you have to have an abbot or somebody give you a blessing to do that. If you don't have a blessing, then you have 3 days.
I was wondering if you went to this church any other day of the year.
Yeah.
Is it possible to actually get in? Oh,
yeah.
Oh, yes.
Yes, definitely. You can. You can go right into the edicule. You can pray right on the stone where Jesus was laid. Yeah. And then there's also the burial, the anointing stone. It's a red stone. where they anointed his body. That's close by too. And you can bring oil back from there. It's amazing. Well worth it.
That's the one where they put the oil on it?
Yeah.
Yeah, when you first go into the giant church of the Holy Sepulchre, there's this slab of beautiful pink marble, and there's like 200 lampadas around it. But every once in a while, one of these darling nuns will come by with a little pot of olive oil. And it's marble and olive oil. And she just splays this olive oil on the stone and then backs up, because every one of us are coming there with a special handkerchief that we have brought with us to put it in that oil, and that olive oil becomes myrrh scented.
Yeah.
And I went in 2000 and my napkin is still pregnant with myrrh.
Yes.
Do we know if anybody got killed or somebody got ill from the fire?
Got ill from it?
Healed.
I didn't meet anybody that got healed, but I don't know. I don't remember anything like that. It's not really known for healing.
You got healed.
I got healed. And lots of people get healed. But yeah, I'm sure there are, but I don't know stories like that personally. Mm-hmm. Yes?
When we were at that the service that we had for the traveling icon.
Right.
The
myrrh gushing icon.
Yeah, uh-huh. Yes.
That we were talking about last week.
We took home those little pieces.
Right.
And I noticed as I left with it that it was stronger than it was when I first got it.
Uh-huh.
And I put it in a special little place. And it, at first, I thought that it was kind of fading over the months. Hmm. But as I prayed and asked the Theotokos to help me know her better,
mm-hmm.
and that it has gotten stronger again.
Mm, wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
For a little tiny piece.
Well, I know that I received a blessing just preparing to talk to you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I felt a little recharge of this
mm-hmm.
grace, and I'm hoping that each of you has felt something like that as well, to strengthen your faith and to give you hope and to guide you, you know, in Lent towards experiencing this again.
Yes.